You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
The University of Warwick hosted the 6th Global University Summit in central London between the 28th and the 30th of May 2013, welcoming 150 invited delegates representing 27 countries and more than 70 universities from around the world. My name is Chris Parr and I attended the summit, which this year focused on the relationship between universities and economic growth. It used its programme of presentations and workshops to formulate what it called a Global University Summit Declaration, to be handed over to a representative from the G8 group of wealthiest nations in a bid to influence its discussions on higher education. Speakers included the Russian ambassador to the UK, a secretary of state, various university chancellors and vice chancellors, and leaders from the world of industry. One of the first people I spoke to, however, was Boris Johnson, the Mayor of London and a former Conservative Shadow Minister for Higher Education. During my interview, he would declare the late Margaret Thatcher the single biggest benefactress of higher education and extol the virtues of London to any would-be international students. However, I began by asking him about the impending public sector spending review and whether the government should be considering cuts to the HE sector's budget.
Are you concerned about the government's sort of financial approach to higher education?
I think the government understands that you've got to fund higher education properly, and the big thing that they did, which was obviously set in train by Labour, but which in the end was completely the right thing to do, was to sort out the tuition fees problem. And we've been going down this track for years and years and years, and they finally did it, and that was probably the single most important thing. I think it's very important the government continues to invest in higher education in London, but you can't fault them for courage.
It's already investing a lower percentage of GDP than the average of OECD nations. I mean, you've got 30 odd universities inside the M25. They must be disappointed. Acknowledge that's not quite enough.
I think you should look at the incredible things that London higher education is doing. It's an amazing fact that we've got 13% of all the international students in the world. We've got more foreign students in London than any other city in the world. There are 45 HE institutions, 23 universities. It employs 98,000 people. Probably generates about £16 billion. It's a massive winner for the UK economy. Of course, we're going through tough times, so I think the government has done very, very well to grasp the nettle and to get long-term sustainable finance. And by the way, I think that all dons, all academics, should pay tribute to Margaret Thatcher, who, after all, was responsible for the change in the law that meant that international students had to make a contribution for their study. And you will recall that it was that decision which prompted the Dons of Oxford, unprecedentedly, to deny her an honorary doctorate. And I think that they should recognise that actually she turned out to be the single biggest benefactress of our education politically that I can think of in the last 20, 30, 40 years. And if they had, then what the Dons should do is immediately give her a posthumous doctorate or name a college in her honour. As the academics rake in the gold, they can thank Margaret Thatcher for the change in the law.
They'd get a little bit more, though, wouldn't they, if there was a better image sent out internationally about the UK as a destination?
I think we need to explode the myths. London is the world capital of higher education. It's the Athens, the Rhodes of the global economy. Rhodes was the great university town in the ancient world. It has more, as I say, it already has more foreign HE students than any other city on earth, and we need to get that message across. We welcome international students, and where there are problems with visas, we must sort them out. I think one of the problems is very often that there's a lot of noise about the visa issue, and people get the wrong end of the stick. There's no cap on student visas for London, for the UK.
Well, there are restrictions on them staying after they graduate. Are you trying to say that the image is fine abroad, or has it been damaged in recent months?
I certainly think that it's very important that we stress that London is open for students, And where there are problems, such as the restriction on, such as the minimum threshold for earnings for postgraduates, which I do think is a problem, then we should address that. And if you ask me, do I rejoice in the fall in international student numbers that we seem to have seen in the last year or so, then no, I don't think that's a great economic signal. I think that we need to show that we're open for business. But I stress, I think the government is you know, they are dealing with very, very tight times financially, and higher education is one of the great success stories of this economy.
Mr. Johnson, thank you.
Thank you.
In a rare return to the brief that he held between 2005 and July 2007, Mr. Johnson went on to deliver a 30-minute speech on higher education to assembled delegates. He called on British universities to exploit their natural advantage on the global stage to further sell their brands overseas, but warned that one of those natural advantages might soon be somewhat compromised.
Because other countries are obviously running to catch up with us, and it's a very, very competitive market. I would stress, I'm very confident. I think there are lots of natural advantages here in London. Got the right time zone. But no way of changing that. We have more museums than Paris, free, which is an important scholastic point, and more museums than Paris, free museums too, here in London, thanks to the wisdom of our leaders. We have less rainfall than rain, twice as many bookshops as New York, and a relevant consideration for anybody thinking about which university town to come to, we have more Michelin-starred restaurants than Paris, in another statistic that I haven't had time to verify in the last couple of years. What I can tell you with absolute assurance is that, and I know this is perhaps of even greater importance, we have a wonderfully safe, clean, green city. We not only have a fantastic communist bike hire scheme sponsored by a bank, we've got the cleanest new bus in the world, we've got crime levels down by more than 10, by 11% in the last 4 or 5 years, this big period entirely at random. We have the lowest murder rates now in our city than we've seen since the 1950s or 1960s, and about a fifth of the murder rate in New York, by the way, just, you know, don't want to be, you know, took it on a negative campaign, but it's chuck it out there. But we no longer have, if we ever did, a monopoly of one of our greatest assets, because they already speak it in Australia and in Canada and in after fashion, obviously in America. But I now see shock horror. I now see in my copy of Libération. And you can't believe that, what can you believe? That the French themselves are going to be following the example of the Swedish and the Germans, and they are going to be teaching their university courses en anglais, mes amis. And I think we need to get going. We need to get going before the French have mastered our language. I think we can be very confident.
Also speaking at the summit, but delivering his speech in a rather more serious tone, was Vince Cable, the Secretary of State for Business, Innovation and Skills, who, like Boris, addressed the way in which government immigration policy is impacting on universities. He seemed to back the long-running lobbying campaign to get international students removed from the net migration figures that the government has pledged to cut from the hundreds of thousands to the tens of thousands. Here he is, addressing delegates.
One of the problems we have, and those in the university sector in the UK will be painfully familiar with that, stems from a rather strange statistical anomaly that the United Nations, in its wisdom, has classified overseas students as immigrants. Of course, they're not, but the definition of an immigrant is somebody who stays in a country for more than 12 months. So they have been counted in the number of immigrants coming into the UK and have therefore been caught up in this very highly emotive debate around immigration, which we have, and not just the UK. All the evidence we have, and there have been some very good survey work done at Oxford University, suggests that the British public don't see overseas students as immigrants. They see them in a quite different way, in a much more positive way, but nonetheless they have got caught up in this very torrid and emotional arguments about the numbers of immigration, immigrants. So as a consequence, when university overseas students increase their numbers in the UK, this is easily translated into a flood of immigrants. And when last week the number declines, this is a great triumph for immigration control, which is quite absurd and unfortunately is seriously distorting the debate on sensible university policy and indeed sensible immigration policy. But I just want to make it absolutely clear that as far as the government's concerned, we have no cap on the number of overseas students. We don't propose to introduce one. As members of the government go around the world trying to increase the numbers of course legitimate overseas students, there has been a problem, a fairly minor problem, but nonetheless a real problem of suburbous institutions, particularly doing English language teaching, but nonetheless our broad approach to this is a positive and outward-looking one.
I spoke to the Secretary of State after his address, and since it's he who will oversee the Department of Business, Innovation and Skills negotiations with the Treasury over an expected 8% cut to its budget, I asked him if university leaders should be preparing for the worst.
Well, I'm certainly not preparing people for the worst, because I think we did some very tough reforms, as you know, with higher education, the effect of which on the sector were to increase their income. It's one of the few bits of the public sector, widely defined, I don't know, universities are not public sector, narrowly defined, but which actually has an increase in resources rather than a decrease because of the way we did the fees thing. But we can't repeat that trick, you know. It was done once, and what we now have to do is to make sure that, university research and teaching, what's left of the teaching grant, science are properly supported, and I'm making a very good case for that. The business community is absolutely behind it, actually. The university sector will be pleased to hear that the CBI and particularly are wading behind, strongly behind it. And I think the industrial strategy is now very firmly embedded. So I'm optimistic that the rational argument for government investment in those activities will be upheld.
It has been increased, but it's still below the sort of OECD average, isn't it?
Yes,
annoyed to hear it's going down.
No, well, that's why. Well, I'm certainly not arguing for reductions. I mean, I think we have bottomed out. Science spending has been protected, at least in nominal terms, not in real terms. And in a rational world, we would be increasing it. You're quite right. And certainly I will argue for that, but we don't know what will happen.
The theme of the 2013 Global University Summit was the relationship between universities and economic growth. A roundtable discussion chaired by Sir Richard Lambert, former Director General of the CBI and current Chancellor of the University of Warwick, looked at how UK universities could boost their relationship with smaller companies. Sir Richard said it was easier for larger companies to collaborate with British institutions because they understood intellectual property protocols and knew where the talent was. Speaking to us after the discussion, he said why it was so important for universities to engage with small and medium-sized enterprises.
Well, if you look at the UK and compare it with Germany or France, you see that there's less engagement by small firms with universities in this country than there is in those places. And I'm not completely sure that I know the explanation. It's partly that it's a generational thing. You know, the people who are running small firms are of a generation that might not have any direct experience of universities themselves, and so they don't. It's not part of their natural view of the world as it would be now, when whatever 40% of people are going through university, it'll be a much less, more familiar world. That's part of it. Part of it is that they've had a hellish hard time staying in business for the last few years. And focusing on survival rather than on the longer term. It's partly because if you look at a man called John Van Rien, the LSE produced some analysis of management quality in the UK compared with other developed economies, and it found that in the front cohort in the UK is very, very good, but there's a long tail of poorly managed companies, sort of lifestyle companies, who are perhaps not energetic enough to get stuck into it. But if we could get more small and medium-sized business engaged, then we would move up the innovation league tables. If you look at the OECD numbers, I don't have them in my head, but we're not in the top. We're not in the top half dozen OECD countries when it comes to innovation and innovation is the key to productivity growth. You know, we need innovation to drive productivity, to make the society, to raise well-being and prosperity of our society as a whole. So I think it is very important.
But who needs to drive that? You mentioned the government did wonders in the last 15 years, increasing, you know, overall integration,
yeah,
but perhaps not on that scale. Who drives it? Universities, government?
It's a bit of everything, actually. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's... I mentioned the Aston case. I think it was Aston who got innovation vouchers, which have now been copied, and that's being replicated around the place. So that was an initiative by the university, actually then with the help, I think, of the Regional Development Agency. Now it would have to be the LEPs, the Local Enterprise Partnerships, that did that. So the universities have a role to play. Government, I think, does a good job. We've mentioned the HIFE stuff before. It's very important that that's sustained through these cuts. It's an obvious message there.
Yeah.
Very important that that's sustained. Businesses, well, maybe have to wake up and smell the coffee a bit.
The summit came to a close when Nigel Thrift, Vice-Chancellor of the University of Warwick, handed the declaration of the 2013 Global Universities Summit to Dominic Martin, Director of the G8 Presidency Unit. The document, formulated over the course of the event, calls on the world's most powerful political leaders to do all they can to help universities contribute to the recovery of the global economy. Among other recommendations, it asks the G8 to recognise that the principles of international free trade also apply to ideas and knowledge, and to take action to allow easier movement of students, academics and researchers between states. It also calls for more investment in universities and asks for a commitment to long-term investment to ensure that higher education institutions are given enough time and resource to develop effective relationships with business. However, perhaps we should give the last word to Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, who had a few words for delegates as to why London, and more widely the UK, has little to fear, in his opinion, from international higher education competition.
We have had huge improvements in our traffic news, and I must tell you that the traffic used to be far worse in London, because it was in 1933 that a Hungarian physicist called Leo Szilard was stuck in Southampton Row, in Bloomsbury, and in this 1933, so he had a pretty old kind of car. Then another car came up behind him and whacked his car, and his car shot forward and hit the car in front, and the car in front hit the car in front of that one. And at that moment, Leo Szilard had an absolutely brilliant idea for a theory that, of course, has been of colossal importance for us in the 20th and 21st century. What was it? Come on, it's only, what was the idea? 10, 20, come on, you brilliant physicists. What was the... Not fusion, almost, that's fission. Correct. It was the chain reaction. It was the idea of a chain reaction that popped into his head when his car was knocked by another car. And this morning I want to take my text from the world of nuclear physics, expert as I am, as Christian just pointed out, in that subject, and ask you to envisage London not as a cyclotron of cars, but a cyclotron of human beings, and a nuclear reactor in which human beings meet and jostle, bump into each other, and occasionally there is this flash of inspiration, and some colossal, stellar new talent is born. Why? We have a famous London author called William Shakespeare, who... We claimed him for London, though, like so many London talents, he, of course, came from elsewhere. He was originally from Stratford-on-Avon. And why did Shakespeare become Shakespeare? It wasn't because he was sitting alone in some garret in Stratford-on-Avon with a bad haircut, meditating on his... It was because he came to London and he had to compete in the great cyclotron of talent with Fletcher and Marlowe and Decker and Webster and all these other guys who you probably can recite. In the great... exercise of putting bums on seats in London theatres. And similarly, famous London scientist Robert Hooke, you asked me to quote some Latin there, which I'm going to tell you. Does anybody know Hooke's law of stress? Ut tensio sic vis is what Hooke came up with, as strange as equal to stress. And he came from, I think, the Isle of Wight. And he didn't formulate his ideas sitting alone in the other way. He formulated his ideas because he came to those London coffee shops and had to compete with Flamsteed and Boyle and Newton and what have you, and that was why he made the breakthroughs that he did. And there's a technical term from nuclear physics for the agglomeration of talent that I'm talking about, the agglomeration of fissile material that you need. I'm looking keenly at all you physicists here. There's a technical term for the necessary, the critical mass. The critical mass is what you need. Thank you very much. The critical mass is what you need. And that is what we have in London. We have the critical mass of talent. Because we have, here in London, more universities virtually than any other city on earth, 45 higher education institutions, 23 universities, 4 in the top 100, 2 in the top 20. More foreign students here in London than I think any other city on earth, and certainly more Chinese students, I'm delighted to say, than any other city in the world outside China. Obviously, we can't compete with
Chinese. You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.